Jr. against Janet R. Brandenstein, Mr. Kitzman, Mr. Duff.
Morning,
counsel. Mr. Kitzman, would you care to reserve any of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, I would. 2 minutes, please.
All right. I'm glad to hear from you when you're ready to go.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is John Kitzman, and I represent appellant Henry Brandenstein. The facts of the case are straightforward, Your Honors. The parties were married, Henry and Janet. They executed a marital separation agreement, and that agreement was incorporated into the order of divorce. And the case revolves around the issue of spousal support. The parties' agreement that was incorporated into the court's order provided that Henry was to pay spousal support to Janet. It further provided that beginning in 2013, that amount would be modified each year, retroactive to January 20th.
Counsel, you can assume we're familiar with,
yes,
with the agreement.
The issue is that Henry was held in contempt by the trial court for doing exactly what the agreement provided that he was to do. He was to make a modification each year by looking at two pieces of information: his income, W-2 and K-1 from 2009. He was to compare that to his income from the prior year, use a percentage difference, and apply that to the existing spouse's support.
Well, he was also required to provide the documentation, supporting documentation to the wife for the purposes of audit or verification, if you will, correct?
Exactly, Your Honor.
He provided a redacted. How do we interpret that? I mean, it seems to me he at least arguably breached at least that portion of the agreement by providing the redacted was W-2 or K-1s, whichever it was.
Well, the contempt order doesn't hold him in contempt for that, so I don't think that's before the court. But to the extent he did provide the redacted paperwork, that's true. He eventually did provide unredacted paperwork. What the agreement provides is that once he makes the calculation, he's to provide paperwork to his former wife so that she may confirm.
Let's see if we can cut to the chase here.
Yes, sir.
The trial court essentially reached its conclusion based on two findings that it made. One, that the agreement was not self-executing, and secondarily, that it was ambiguous, correct?
Is that, yes, sir,
a fair summary of it?
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to me the only issues we have to resolve is as a matter of law, is either of those conclusions correct?
I agree.
So tell us first why the document is, in fact, self-executing. It's not self-executing.
Right. Well, the trial court found, as a matter of fact, that the parties themselves intended to be self-executing. And whenever we look at an agreement, you're here to look at it de novo. We start first with the agreement itself. And the agreement itself doesn't speak of the trial court's involvement at all, except in one instance, and that's if Henry's disabled.
And you've made that argument, but it also allows for the ending of support payments if there's a finding of cohabitation consistent with the statute. And we've been pretty clear that that is not self-executing. So there are at least two instances where you'd have to go to the court.
That is true. And the cohabitation issue is really the one issue where this court has issued a ruling on these self-executing agreements in spousal support situations. The other one is Wheeler v. Wheeler, which is an unpublished case, but it deals with a situation exactly like this. There was a partner at Hunt & Williams, and he was able to adjust his spousal support by agreement each year based on his draw. And the wife in that case argued that the word draw was ambiguous. The trial court held that we start and we end with the words of the agreement, and the agreement uses the word draw, and it's not an ambiguous term. There's nothing for us to do. We just apply it to the situation. So
I think we've got two separate concepts we've got to deal with, and I think we're in danger of mixing apples with oranges here. It seems to me under basic contract law, ambiguity, whether there's any ambiguity or not, is certainly analytically different from whether it's self-executing or not. If there's ambiguity in a contract, that's resolved typically by looking at the contract as a whole to determine what the intent of the parties was. And if that fails, then you take extrinsic evidence or parole evidence.
Exactly.
And that wasn't done here, correct?
Well, actually,
or at least the parole evidence wasn't taken here, was it?
It actually was. There was quite a bit of evidence on that. We had Henry Brandenstein testified as to what the lawyers in the case, in drafting the agreement, said it was going to do. And he testified that the two lawyers, while they were drafting it, said that it was intended to be self-executing, that there was supposed to be a formula, it was going to be easy to administer, and that the amount from K-1, box 1, would be used as the marker.
And in fact, At one point, the trial court, and I know you weren't trial counsel, criticized Mr. Brandenstine's counsel for offering the parole, and he had to clarify, we think it's self-executing and not ambiguous, and you don't need parole, but you've said you think it's ambiguous, so now I'm giving you the parole.
I think the trial court very early in the trial said, I think this is ambiguous, and I think the trial court throughout the proceedings took that position. And so I think trial counsel was just doing what they would have to do, which is, if the court is going to take that position that's ambiguous.
Well, from what I can discern from the record, the trial court wasn't terribly specific about what it found to be ambiguous.
I think I can't too much because the trial court doesn't say too much about it. What the trial court says is we have two experts who the trial court heard to disagree as to what income was. I don't think the experts did disagree. I think they both said that Box 1 K1 is the income that flows through from a partner in a law firm. And the trial court just said, I think what the trial court says specifically was the parties themselves disagree over what the income is, and therefore it's ambiguous. This court has held over and over that just because the parties to an agreement disagree as to what it means doesn't render an agreement ambiguous. If that was the case, every agreement would be up in the air. We would never have a binding agreement because one party or the other would just say, I disagree as to what it means. I think that was the root that the trial court was stuck with. Janet Brandenstine said, I disagree with what he did. And the judge said, well, that renders it ambiguous. And I just think that's contrary to this court's holding entirely. I think you have to look at the agreement, and I go through that in the brief. The agreement language itself is very clear. It simply says, look at W-2, K-1, and then other income. And that's like any other formula. You see that in royalty contracts. You see that in sales commission contracts. You see it in bonus contracts. And if one party disagrees, then the answer is not to throw out the royalty contract. If there's an audit or whatnot, the party, the recipient of the monies, can take it to court and say, he breached the contract. He's not paying me the royalty I'm due or the commission I'm due.
Having found that it was not self-executing, when the trial court set the arrearage that it found was due, didn't it adopt the what had been apparently self-executing, because there was no court order changing it from $8,000 a month? It was went with the stepped up 2012, I think it is, number that no court had ruled on.
That's exactly right.
The parties had reached it through finding it self-executed.
Right. That issue wasn't particularly raised here. Arguably, the last amount that was done way back in time would still be binding, because under the court's theory, the trial court's theory, you'd always have to come back to court. But the court did adopt what Henry did in 2013 and said that's going to be the amount, and took that to the court's breast. And then a year later, when he did exactly the same thing, they held him contempt for that. So
if it wasn't self-executing in 2013, what would be what is your understanding of the trial court's basis for using that figure to set the arrearage?
The trial court didn't give a reason for that. They simply adopted that reason. I don't know even if anyone asked for that. But either the language is ambiguous and you throw out the whole thing and we go back to square one.
Well, if it's ambiguous, you don't throw it out. You try to determine what the actual intent was through extrinsic
evidence. Indeed. And what the court's position on that was...
What the court did was throw it out. That's
right.
Wouldn't it have been easier just to, instead of saying K-1 flow-through income and having the parenthetical, and I understand your arguments regarding that, to say K-1 box 1?
Yes, it would have been easier to do that. But as a lawyer who drafts these agreements all the time on both the business side and...
You get paid by the word, do you?
No. But if we're too specific in agreement, we run the risk that things will change. For instance, if we said box 1, K1, and then, as you know, the federal government changes forms change all the time. If we say, and I do this in contracts all the time, if we say box X, but then next year's form... they've changed it to box 1B. You see this in tax forms all the time. They change the numbering system. Or if we said line 39 on the 1040, that changes. It moves around. So if we're too specific, a few years down the line, our agreements become stale, and then the other party could say, sorry, you said box 1. That's the only thing you're stuck with, and it happens to not be there anymore. That's why we don't get that specific. And so that's why we generally try to capture the concept of income without narrowing it down to a very formalistic box.
Let me follow up on Judge Russell's question. It seems to me, and this is I'll be honest with you, I found this to be an unnecessarily long-winded way of laying out a formula that shouldn't be as complicated as the lawyers seem to have made it here, but having stated that editorial opinion, my point is simply that I think there's some language, and I won't try to find it in the record, but I believe there's some language in the agreement to the effect of it's the intent of the parties to use as the basis for this computation the total income, excluding investment income and all that, but the total, work-related income that the father here receives from whatever source. And in point of fact, it's basically your W-2 form, which is your wages and salary, and your K-1, which is the flow-through income from the firm as an equity partner or whatever, correct?
In this case, that's true, but the parenthetical, I think, was added probably at the urging of the wife's counsel, because what if husband was no longer a partner receiving a K-1? And that's another reason why you wouldn't just say K-1 box one. If he was self-employed and was under a C-corp or doing a real estate, there's different ways you can get income. There might be a 1099.
Well, so, my point is simply that would it be a fair, and I'm just asking, would it be a fair construction of this agreement to conclude that it was the intent of both parties, essentially, whether the intent was actually carried out or not is another question, but it was essentially that to use as the baseline the wages and salaries from whatever source and the flow-through income from whatever source, period, and exclude any other source of income such as capital gains
exactly.
and investment.
I think that is a fair reading.
And if that's the basis, then the next step is to simply, is the mathematical formula one that can be computed essentially, because if it
yes.
can't be, then the trial court is absolutely correct.
Right, and in child support situations, and in Stroud, if I could just address those, in child support situations, normally what we would say is we're going to apply the party's incomes to the child support formula. And so the income, we figure it out. That doesn't render it vague or non-self-executing because income, people may disagree about that. And we put in the child support formula, and that formula is pretty straightforward. In our case, we have a formula that's written out pretty, I think it's absolutely self-executing. It says take the income from 2009, and it gives that actual figure, $544,000 and such. Compare it to last year's income, look at the percentage difference, multiply that percentage difference either up or down by the current support amount, and that's your new amount. And they did it in 2013 with no issue. The only issue in 2014, I think, is that because of the varying amounts of income, the wife simply didn't like the amount. Stroud says that in order for it to be self-executing, there has to be a triggering event that can be empirically determined, such as a date certain. And here we have that as well. We have the January 26th of each year. So we have a formula. We have January 26th, and we have a capture of income. I think we have all the pieces. And if this doesn't work, although it may be long and a little bit repetitive, the language, if this attempt at self-execution doesn't work, I don't know what could. I think we would be rendering all of these agreements on both sides forever invalid if we have to go any further than this. Any other questions?
You have a little over 2 minutes in rebuttal then.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Duff?
Thank you, Your Honors. My name is David Duff. I represent Janet Brandenstein, the former wife in this case.
So what's ambiguous about this?
The income to be used is ambiguous. The term flow-through income, that is what is used in the formula in the spousal support provision, flow-through income.
And wasn't the testimony of both sides CPA that when you use the term flow-through income, that's a term of art that means box one?
No. No, Your Honor.
Can you point me to any place in the record where anybody said where the CPA said that flow-through income was not box one?
The term flow-through was the expert for the wife, Mr. Tierney, testified that pass-through income, and he equated flow-through with pass-through, meaning simply income that went from the paying entity, Venable, to the partner. The pass-through income was not only the ordinary taxable income, box one or part three, line one, same thing, is only that income that flowed to Mr. Brandenstein that is taxable. And Mr. Tierney, the wife's expert CPA, made that very clear. He also went on to say, as Mr. Hal Young, the husband's expert, agreed, that there was other income, $480,000 of cash, that also passed through the partnership coffers into the husband's coffers. So the
monies, the totality of funds that flowed through the partnership into the husband's pocket was more than just contained in taxable. The only problem here is it taxable or not taxable? That was the only issue. Venable changed their reporting purpose or their reporting method and made a chunk, 75% of Mr. Brandenstine's earnings, non-taxable for the year 2013. And so it was rearranged on the K-1 so that what had been the big $500,000 number the previous year now became $129,000 and a big number of non-taxable. But that doesn't change the fact that it still was income that flowed through. But the question was, what is the ambiguity? And that is the ambiguity. What does the term flow-through income mean?
Well, it seems to me that's explained. I'm looking at paragraph small I, I guess, of the agreement. The latter half of that paragraph says, in pertinent part, wife spousal support either upwards or downwards based upon a comparison of the husband's, in this case, 2009 income from his W-2 salary and K-1 flow-through income, and the actual amount is in parentheses. And then an additional parenthetical says, no capital gains income or other income of the husband that is not related to his wages, bonuses, or other employment-related compensation shall be used in the computation of this adjustment, etc. It seems to me that parenthetical is an expression of the parties signatory to the agreement as to what the terms W-2 salary and K-1 flow-through mean.
And I believe, I agree with you, Your Honor, and I believe that's what Judge Nordland, the trial judge, found as well, that the party's intent was not to limit the husband's income for calculation purposes to, quote, box one, but was to include everything in that parenthetical. The parenthetical is a double negative.
Well, I want to ask you about the preceding parenthetical now, the one with the number.
All right.
Matches with box one.
Yeah.
If that's not to indicate box one, what is it there for? Because if you look at the years in question, there's some years that box 19 is higher, and there's some years it's lower. Remarkably, in the year where the adjustment was up, box 19 was lower, and nobody complained about the use of box 1, which appeared to be, from the first parenthetical, what was intended to be used.
That,
you explain the first parenthetical.
My explanation would be that in the year that the first parenthetical is being used, that a specific figure is being quoted, that was the monies that flowed through the man to Mr. Brandenstine.
And it just happened to be in box one.
It just happened to be in box one. It doesn't say box one. I mean, that, as you pointed out, that would be very clear. So now we have to try to anticipate interpret that.
Just because something is not written as clearly as it can be doesn't mean that it's not clear.
Well, it certainly wasn't clear to two competing experts at trial, Your Honor.
I read Mr. Tierney's testimony on page 127 of the exhibit. He's asked, flow through income, that's box one, and he says, I wouldn't disagree with that.
Right. Well, I've cited it, excuse me.
I'm talking about page 127 of the appendix.
And he... on page 124 and 125 of the appendix, just a little bit before Your Honor's cite, as I've quoted on page 11 of my brief, Mr. Tierney speaks about $544,000 to be income that flowed to his side of the ledger. This is income that passed through to his capital account. Question, how much was distributed? How much cash was distributed to this man? $594,000. Not all taxable, but money in his pocket.
Well, right, but if flow-through income, if he agrees that flow-through income, K-1 flow-through income is box one, then the formula is clear. It's you take the flow-through income on K-1 in 2009, which we know is box one, $544,000 and whatever it is, and that's your denominator, the year that we're trying to set the support going forward is your numerator. You do the division. It's a simple math problem.
Your condition precedent is the one I challenge. Does box one constitute flow-through income? Yes, it does. Of course it does. Box one does constitute flow-through income. Is that the totality of his flow-through income? Mr. Tierney makes it clear that no, the totality of this flow-through income includes more than just what's there in box one. And he goes on and he explains that far more than just $129,000 flowed through to this gentleman. Does box one contain his flow-through income? Yes. So there's nothing wrong in what he said, but is that the next question would be, is that the only flow-through income? And the answer to that, had it been asked, would have been no, because he clarified it earlier that this is what the man received. So we've got, I submit, we have an ambiguity in what income is to be used. Judge Nordland ruled, as His Honor pointed out earlier in the second parenthetical, that the parties intended to use all employment-related income. And she got there by saying, well, you've used no non-employment-related income is to be used, ergo, that means employment-related income is to be used. And so then,
does that necessarily follow?
Well, I think it does as a, I hesitate to say common sense, maybe more logistic.
I take Judge Russell's point. It seems to me, and it's, I honestly, at this, as I sit here at this moment, don't know the answer, because the parties chose to use an example in the negative, essentially. And when they could have easily said, instead of the convoluted way they explained it, all income, excluding investment income, would have been, that's essentially what you're arguing the parties meant. If the parties actually meant that, it would have been simple enough to say it, because I said it in a lot less complex manner than the, two, 3.5 pages it took to explain it here.
I can't disagree. That would have been nice, but that isn't what we have.
Because something is not as clear as it can be, you'll concede my earlier question, I think, that just because something's not written as clear as it can be doesn't mean it's not clear.
No, I agree with that, too. But we are left with what is written. And when one says we don't use non-employment related compensation.
But what I think Judge Russell's point, and it's a fair one, is one way to interpret this contract, certainly, is that the parties intended to use W-2 salary and K-1 flow-through income, and the parenthetical I referred to simply expresses the reaffirmation, if you will, that no investment income is to be used. So Judge Russell's point is, yeah, you could take the K-1 box, which clearly is the flow-through income because that's what the box is labeled, and it does, as long as it certainly doesn't contain any investment income, you're good.
Well, Your Honor, I no disrespect, but the box is labeled ordinary business income.
Okay.
Nowhere on the and I understand, is that mincing words? Not really. Because to the average layman, you say, what's flow-through income? You're going to get a blank stare. I suspect to most people you're going to get a blank stare who are not in the accounting field. Box one is labeled ordinary business income. And is it flow-through income? Yes, it flows through. It is flow-through income. And as I said to His Honor, it's not the totality of the flow-through income. There is other flow-through income that is non-taxable. That's only the taxable flow-through income.
Didn't the parties treat the agreement as on the self-execution prong of this, didn't the parties treat it as self-executing in 2013?
They did.
Because nobody went back to court to get an order. And then necessarily in how it calculated the arrearage, if the agreement is not self-executing, doesn't the trial court have to be wrong?
Well, Your Honor, hugely interesting point that you raise.
Thank you.
But the answer, I submit, is what was before Judge Nordland. And she was very careful to say, it's not before me to determine what the spousal support should have been. What is before me is to determine whether or not he paid the appropriate amount. So she wasn't there to recalculate spousal support. She was there to determine, he changed it. Was that appropriate? Was it contemptuous because he changed it and then failed to pay in accordance with the property settlement agreement? He simply did pay for 2 months. That's all that was in front of her.
Well, right. And if the agreement has no self-executing component, then the last court-ordered number from the agreement is the baseline 8,000, not the 8,356 she used to determine the arrearage. Correct?
Well, that would be correct.
Then when she used 8,356 to determine the arrearage, how do you square that it's not self-executing, but using the self-executing amount to determine the arrearage?
Because she wasn't, first of all, that was never argued to her below, and she was never given the opportunity to analyze it in that respect. What was presented to her, and all she was doing, was that an amount was being paid by the former husband. Okay, whether it was in accordance with the court order or not, that's what he was paying. And there was no contention that it was not in accordance or that it was not proper. No argument whatsoever.
Well, right, because they contend that the agreement was self-executing.
Oh, all right, right. But they're wrong. But it wasn't argued for 012. There was no problem with what he paid in 012. It just wasn't argued. I'm trying to put myself in this judge's position.
Assuming you're correct that the entire flow-through is what was intended here, all income from whatever source, not just the K-1 box, why would the agreement still be self-executing? I mean, if that's the interpretation that you say all the parties agreed to, again, I don't want to mix ambiguity with self-execution. It seems to me it's still self-executing if that's what the parties intended. It's still a simple mathematical calculation.
Your Honor, I believe that Judge Nordland followed the language of Judge Agee in his concurring opinion in the Shoup case, where he spoke that to be, I don't want to misquote Judge Agee, to be self-executing requires that the triggering event or adjustment and the terms of any adjustment be clear and definitive. So where Your Honor started today's argument by saying there are really two issues, is it self-executing and is it ambiguous? I think Judge Nordland is saying no, to be self-executing you can't be ambiguous. And if a term, an effectuating term, is ambiguous, then it cannot be self-executing. It still has an issue to be determined by the court. And that issue, as Judge Nordland found, was what income are we to use? Are we to use the income by the husband where he says it's just my taxable income in box one? Or are we to use the income claimed by the wife, which was all work-related compensation?
Do you agree with the trial court's conclusion that it's the intention of the parties to create a self-executing document?
I do.
If the language of the contract can be read in two ways, one of which gives effect to that intention, shouldn't we read it that way?
Well, not if to do so would ignore an ambiguity. I don't think that merely just because parties, as been pointed out, because parties disagree, that doesn't make it ambiguous. If it's ambiguous and just because the parties agree, if there's an ambiguity, we don't even have that here. We have a disagreement and an ambiguity.
Well, no, but if we have an agreement of what they were intending to do.
Yes, sir.
And there's an ambiguity, don't we resolve the ambiguity consistent with their intentions?
We do. And the resolution, the ambiguity, as Judge Nordland found, was that the intent was to use all employment-related compensation.
But she also found it was their intent to create a self-executing document that didn't require a return to the court.
That she found that, and the parties agreed to that. That was their intent. That's what they wanted to do. Of course, my client wanted to do that, understanding that, okay, the term for husband's income would be all of his work-related compensation, whereas the husband wanted it to be self-executed, but only if his income was his taxable income.
Thank you, Counselor. All right, Mr. Kitzman, you have a couple minutes left.
Thank you very much. I think that the two experts' testimony
they're CPAs, and so they talk a little bit different than other folks. But Mr. Young testified that the amount in Box 1 was K-1 flow-through income. He also testified that there was no employment-related compensation other than that on the 2013 tax return.
What's your take on that second parenthetical I quoted, where the, you know, that seems to suggest that, or at least arguably would seem to suggest that the parties intended to, that all wage-related or salary-related income be used in the computation, simply excluding investment income, everything except investment income, essentially?
My take is that you have a parenthetical the first time it's used with the first paragraph, and then when it speaks about 2014 in specific, they leave the parenthetical off. They just say W-2 and K-1 flow-through income to do 2014. So you have to resolve that conflict, and I think you need to resolve it in a way that makes the agreement work and follows the intention of the parties. I think you also have to look at the first parenthetical, which is the 544, which is just K-1, and you also have to look at the fact that earlier, when there were higher distributions and other numbers the parties could have chose, they didn't choose those. They only chose that one. So I think we have to resolve that by looking at what they probably meant. I think you could torture yourself and read that language to mean all sorts of things. But I think if you read it...
I hear your argument basically to be, yeah, it's ambiguous, but the ambiguity can be resolved by simply resorting to the document as a whole.
If you start off with the idea that it's ambiguous, yes. By itself, I think what it says is you're going to do flow-through income, and it's got 544, and we're not going to include these other things, and we are going to include these other things. And I don't think that you can read that paragraph any other way, because if that's what they meant, they would have included all those other things every time they did this, and they just didn't. I just don't think that makes any sense. I don't think the language itself can be read to mean that all income or all compensation, cash, whatever, whether taxable or not, is included, because the parenthetical follows the word flow-through. And flow-through has a very specific term. I cite the United States Supreme Court. This court has also ruled on flow-through. That flow-through means the taxable income from a partnership that flows through to the partner. And so a parenthetical, which is the general following the specific flow-through language, I don't think can change the meaning of that.
Counsel.
Thank you.
We'll go down to Greek Council and take up Callahan versus Conwell.